Hello and a very warm welcome to Political Economy with Shweta Punj. This week around, we are discussing if indeed India should be following the policy of creating national champions. This has been a format of growth which has been tried and tested in several countries, and it's been a success. One of the big examples that's often quoted to India is of Korea. That Korea as a country worked on building its national champions that are now international giants like Samsung, Hyundai, and so on. Well, should India be following that model of growth? This question is coming up more so now after a report by Hindenburg Research and a recent US indictment against an Indian conglomerate, the Adani Group, once again has raised questions around whether India should indeed follow and build national champions. If so, what are the opportunities there and what are the pitfalls of doing so? To understand this in greater detail, I have with me Professor Prasanna Panchi, Associate Professor of Finance at ISB, and Professor Amartya Lahiri. He is Professor of Economics at the University of British Columbia. He's joining us from Vancouver. Thank you very much. I know it's very late for you, Professor Lahiri. Really appreciate the time, joining us for this podcast. The one big question, and you know, there's been so much discussion around this in the last few months specifically, on whether India should indeed follow this format of building national champions. What are national champions? If you could explain that to our listeners and to our viewers, and then of course we'll go on to the next question on whether India should follow that growth model of building national champions.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. So national champions is basically the idea that the state sort of picks a set of conglomerates or industrialists, could be essentially conglomerates. That's been the traditional, model. And so the state sort of picks a few conglomerates that it thinks are the ones that can deliver on state goals, can implement projects that the state wants done. And the quid pro quo to that is that the state, tries to enable preferential conditions or protected conditions in domestic markets, etc., to sweeten the pot, so to speak, for these national champions.
So that's
been the national champion model, which East Asia followed, which South Korea, Japan have been the typical participants or the typical countries that have actually done this, and it was fairly successful in East Asia. As we all know, the Chaebols and the Keiretsus in Japan have done really well. And a lot of the state success in these countries are attributed to the pivotal role that these conglomerates played.
So, Professor Lahiri, is that the way for India as well? Do we see that trend rising in India? And is that something that you see India adopting more aggressively as, India aspires to become a $5 trillion economy and so on?
So clearly, India has adopted that model. That at least seems to be the outcome that we have been seeing for the last 5-7 years. That's been the progressive path that India has taken of isolating a few or identifying a few of these conglomerates that the state has confidence in that they can deliver on projects. Now, all emerging economies, the biggest hurdle is really to get the infrastructure, investments in place and provision at the scale that the country needs when it's growing. And that has proven to be a bit of a problem. It's a general problem for many countries. It's primarily because infrastructure has a public good component to it. And so often the private returns are lower than the social gains. And so oftentimes, private businesses are unwilling to invest in these because the returns are not necessarily all private. And so financing infrastructure projects was traditionally done through tax revenues. That's what the governments would actually invest by using their tax revenues. But then there is a you know, a bit of a poorer countries have trouble building these things because tax revenues are low, because these countries are poor. And so then you get into a bit of a trap. Because you're poor, you can't invest. And therefore, if you can't invest in infrastructure, you can't get out of the poverty trap. And so India in the early 2000s, as is well known, tried this public-private partnership model where, the private sector was, essentially made a partner in this infrastructure investment with the idea that the state would support them with preferential access to credit from the public sector banks, with land acquisitions and so on and so forth. And those, the private sector would run those projects once they, implemented them for about 20, 30 years. Mm. Unfortunately, that ran into lots of non-performing asset problems. And so we ended up with an avalanche of those NPAs in the early 2010s, around 2010, 2011. And so that model was abandoned with a lot of black clouds hovering over that entire setup. And so right. Then this government has kind of, once the NDA government came on board, they kind of adopted the same infrastructure. They thought infrastructure is important, but the PPP model wasn't going to work. Tax revenues were scarce. And so they went with this national champions model, saying, let's find a few conglomerates that can implement what we want in terms of both hard infrastructure and soft infrastructure. And let's see if this works out okay. And there is a role model out there, which is the East Asian economy. So that's what they've done. So India clearly has done it. Now, is this going to work the same way that it did in East Asia? That is the big question.
Right.
And there are some conditions here which are not quite the same as operated in East Asia in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And that the biggest hurdle there is that, to go from a world where a bunch of, conglomerates are incentivized to do stuff that the government wants them to do, and yet they have some incentive to grow and be efficient at the same time, requires a certain kind of market efficiency to coexist with market protection. So the East Asian economies basically found that method by linking a lot of the domestic protections that were given to these conglomerates, linking them to the export targets. So exports were prioritized, and that's what these the Korean firms, did. They operated in protected domestic markets, but they had to meet export targets, which were very explicit. The Chinese public sector, firms did the same thing. They had the export targets, they were meeting them. Unfortunately, what has happened, fortunately or unfortunately, the WTO rules that operate today make those things illegal. Any country that tries to put explicit export links is going to get hauled up due to violations of WTO. So one really can't do that anymore. So the challenge then is, how do you keep these guys invested and incentivized to be competitive globally while enjoying this domestic protection? So because what is the incentive? If it's not to compete abroad, if you can't get them to do that, can very easily become a crony capital kind of world. And that's the tension.
Okay. Let me bring in Professor Tantri here. Prasanna, you have been, advising the Indian government, and you're on the board of several PSUs and so on. And Professor Lahiri has really broken it down on, the India model, how it has panned out in the last few years. I want to talk to you about, when you think about it, that, okay, you nurture some Indian businesses, or you nurture some, your national businesses to promote your priorities, to promote your national goals. On the face of it, I don't find anything wrong with it. I think, there are certain priorities, there are certain things that India needs, and Indian companies are best poised to deliver on that. And, just as a question to, Professor Lahiri's point on currently the global environment is very different. When this happened in the East Asian economies in the 80s, it was a very export-driven market, and now things have changed. Having said that, India does have to guard its strategic interests, and there is also a lot of domestic demand within India that it can cater to. Prasanna, I want your thoughts on this.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Shweta. And Professor Lahiri has actually, you know, given a class on, you know, what's national champion, and I don't think I need to repeat. Just add some couple of clarification based on my understanding of what happened in India. You know, yes, we did start with this PPP model in the early 2000s. But, you know, it is the way we promoted national champions is was slightly different than many other countries did. For instance, we went for, you know, preferential allocation of natural resources. It is one thing to say, you know, we will give you protection from external competition, or, you know, we will have a favorable tax regime which applies to all. That is different. On the other hand, we went for extreme cases like, you know, a group of bureaucrats deciding on coal allocations. You know, the 2G thing that you know is very well known, where some of the conglomerates exactly knew how much is, you know, they are brought in the demand draft before.
But that's corruption, isn't that corruption? As in, that's corruption. That was not by design.
Exactly. So this promoting national champions is a thin line between corruption and, you know, that is where things go wrong with this promoting certain conglomerates' idea. And even on NPAs, as we discussed, you know, we spent an hour last time, if you remember, things were going fine up to 2006, 2007. What changed was this extending forbearance even after the crisis was over. You know, government finding a nice way of using zero tax dollars. I understand it's a mix of tax dollars versus private money and some support from public sector undertakings. We went from, you know, that model using zero tax dollars for CapEx. CapEx came to like 0.5%, 1% of budget, and doing everything through, you know, public sector funding, banks funding, you know, basically private infrastructure, you know, businesses. So going extreme on one side, where state would take the downside and private sector keeps the upside, was what we adopted before. That led to total collapse. So my worry is that when we promote national champions, we should also recognize our past mistakes and understand the costs. You know, there are costs that come associated with it. One of the big costs of promoting large enterprises is innovations usually come from smaller guys, right? Mm. So look at India, you know, people created through in private sector today. Blinkit, for instance, is a true Indian innovation. It doesn't exist anywhere in the world. You know, that did not come from rates or large people. You know, it came from a startup kind of an idea. So I think Indian competitive advantage today are these bright young minds, startups. And if at all we have to promote someone, I think I would advise the government to promote these kind of people, startups, youngsters with new ideas, because that is the one that can, you know, create competitive advantage, sustainable. Promoting certain large groups, you know, will eventually, even the Japanese case, we so much talk about this. Eventually, Japanese slowdown, if you study carefully, is the failure of the same credit series which led to success. You know, they became banks. You know, they started funding all real estate. Real estate prices started going up. And it went up so much that people couldn't afford. And then they are still not out of that crisis. It's the everlasting crisis in Japan. So while they helped grow, they sort of permanent crisis. So whereas this innovation-led, startup-led kind of growth, which, you know, India is filled with young people right now, filled with ideas. And if government can support that with taxation, and in fact, we had a hostile tax regime. We had about supporting them. It's only in the recent budget, if you know, some of the taxes.
That's right.
I think so. That would be a better way rather than promoting conglomerates. That's what I think.
Okay, so both of you, Professor Lahiri and Professor Tantri, are saying that India should not adopt a policy of promoting national champions. My question to both of you is, considering the big infrastructure ambitions that we have, considering the fact that we need to build linkages, we need to enable businesses to become more efficient. We need more ports, we need more roads, highways, better connectivity, and so on. These are big investments we are talking about. So in that scenario, looking at the current needs of India, startups, Prasanna, when I see your point on startups, my first question is that startups, there maybe one in 50 or one in 100 startups will operate in this infrastructure creation space. So considering the needs of our country, which are which are very unique, and the challenges are also very unique, how does one go about it? As in, if you're promoting a national champion and it's serving the goal of the infrastructure creation of your country, the goal of creating infrastructure in your country, and it comes at a big investment. So, but both of you are advising against that. Then how do we accomplish those goals? Professor Larry, I want your thoughts in on this.
So let me actually say, I actually didn't explicitly say that, it's necessarily a bad thing. All I'm saying is that it's not clear to me that, that there is an appropriate balancing. There are risks involved in going down the national champions route. And the risk basically from just the efficiency perspective of an economy is that, that the more closely associated conglomerate gets with a government, from a regulatory standpoint, it creates a sense that these guys are too big to fail. And so then it creates this regulatory forbearance issue that was just mentioned, and that creates its own. Prasanna was talking exactly the right thing, that, it creates its own problem that, which is what we are seeing right now with the whole Adani hysteria. I mean, it's like there is this notion that is there regulatory forbearance going on, which then, challenges or threatens all kinds of other sorts of foreign direct investment that might, external funds that are, otherwise might come in. Might just get spooked because they don't know the regulatory environment, because private capital really requires a fair bit of confidence in the regulatory environment. And so that is the risk in because we are reliant of, at least about 3-4% of GDP has to flow in as foreign funds every year for us to just finance that stuff.
Right.
And so that is a constant risk that we are facing. And so that's the national champions risk. Now that said, you raise an excellent point that, we do need the infrastructure. And so, we have tried the whole issue, this national champions model. I'm distinguishing the PPP from the national champions. The national champions is what I refer to as the post-2015 kind of world. The PPP, I kind of talk about almost as like the 2000s kind of model. And so here we've the PPP model was much more diffused. I mean, a lot of people had got their fingers in the pie. Here, it's much more focused on, three or four groups. And that's where it takes a slightly different hue. Now, it has to get done. There is a lot of infrastructure requirement in a growing country. But I would like to put it somewhat, in a different way. We have kind of taken a Vegas, Bugsy Siegel kind of approach to infrastructure. It's like build it and they shall come. But infrastructure is also, you build too much infrastructure, if there's not enough demand for it, it's, people aren't going to pay for it. If you build big toll roads, that there isn't much demand for it. So yeah, if you give it away for free, people are going to be driving on it. But if they don't find much use for it, the moment you start charging a toll, nobody's going to show up. And that project is essentially going to become, it's going to turn into an NPA very quickly. And so the question is, how much demand is there for this infrastructure? Is an important question to ask. We almost take it as a holy grail that there has to be demand. But the fact is, if you give free electricity, people will buy. The moment you start charging for it, people don't want to pay. And so that's about saying something about effective demand. How much effective demand is there? So, of course, if it's a booming export sector, the ports are in massive demand. So if you start building roads from the ports inside, it's going to be heavily trafficked. On the other hand, if there is not enough activity going on, just building roads or big ports isn't going to sort of solve your problem. However, the other side is, if you actually create conditions where there is massive demand for this stuff, even the private sector finds ways of doing it. I mean, I grew up around Delhi. There were all these cities that, little towns that were basically industry towns. There was Modi Nagar, there was Mohan Nagar, there was all these places just grew around it, based completely on private sector funding. They created there. So we had steel cities coming up all over. I mean, you know, private sector, Burnpur and Asansol, you had Jamshedpur. These were all privately funded. These were not state funded. So infrastructure was created because there was a demand for it. And so I think at some point we've kind of gone, I'm a little worried that we've decided that infrastructure, you know, it's like you build it and everything else will follow. And I'm not sure that that is appropriately being thought through, that there has to be a different side, that if you create enough demand for it, the money will come and it will get built on its own.
Okay.
You know, the private sector will fund it.
Right. Let me bring in Prasanna here. Prasanna, you know, we spoke about providing protection also to national champions. So there is one, you provide protection. The second is you provide them with an enabling environment with the promise and with the hope that they will deliver on, you know, building what a country needs. So when we look at India's national champions policy so far, where do you think, you know, I don't want to talk about the years where we saw crony capitalism and where we saw actually corruption. And I don't think that's creating national champions really. That was just, a bad phase in the India growth story where power was getting misused and so on. And, there was a lot of cronyism that's happening, and hopefully we are past that. So, when it comes to protection, do you think at this point we do need to provide protection to Indian businesses so that they are able to grow and they're able to create jobs and invest in the country? And then, of course, we'll go back to the point that Professor Lahiri has made on just India's policy of creating infrastructure, assuming that there will be demand. We'll take that up later, but I want to, just pick your brains on this point on providing protection. What's the right way of doing this? Because other countries have done it. It's been a success. And what is the right way of doing it? What's your suggestion?
Yeah, so will you allow me to start with that infrastructure point so that we can complete that thought and then come to
absolutely.
This,
sure, please go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
So I can't agree more with Professor Lahiri when he said about infrastructure. See, in finance, we are guided by one metric, which is whether an investment is positive NPV. If an investment is positive NPV, which it adds net present value, capital will come. You know, if it is a negative NPV, then you have to ask the question, why do you want to do a project despite it being negative NPV? That requires a lot of discussion. And maybe there are strategic objectives and, you know, reasons why you may still want to do it. That is a case where you may want to give some concessions. Maybe you want to build a border road and it's necessary. And you want to L&T, it's a loss-making proposition for L&T. And you subsidy or something that makes sense. But otherwise, if it's a positive NPV problem, either state or a private player should be funded. I don't see why you need some champion for it if it's a positive NPV problem. And bigger problem in the infrastructure is last time, our savings rates are going down. We were at a 37% savings rate. Today we are at 29%. So whether you build national champions or not, and our FDI is hardly not even a percent. Professor Lahiri was talking about 3-4%. Net FDI this year will be $15 billion. $15 billion on $2 trillion is nothing. So even if you build national champions, where will you get the money from? You know, that is the, in fact, that should be a bigger worry, that where do you get savings and funding from for infrastructure, then whether 2 players should do it or 10 players should do it. If it's a positive NPV project, even 20 people will do it. Why not?
But okay, you know, let me just come in here. So if you get a private company to do a major infrastructure project for you, for the country, then that it falls on them, right? The responsibility of raising funds, executing it, and so on. What you're doing is you're giving them the project, you're telling them that, you know, this is your timeline, these are your deadlines, I need this kind of return. So doesn't that, and in the process, it creates jobs, and in the process, it generates, you know, it builds the economy in that area.
Yes, but where do they raise money from? The pool, you know, it used to be 37% of GDP, which is our savings, is today 29% of GDP. They have to raise domestically or from abroad. There is only so much you can do from abroad. Bigger worry, if you're worried about infrastructure, you should worry about falling savings rate. It's not two companies doing it or three, and our inability to replace FDI, you know, that I'm okay with falling savings rate as long as you can get FDI. So that is a bigger problem in the long run for infrastructure, rather than three companies doing it or companies doing it. And then we have to think about ways of, you know, in fact, our taxation system right now is actually whatever incentive we had for encouraging savings, we are removing it in the name of simplicity. So it will make things worse. So if at all you're worried about infrastructure, savings is a bigger problem than two, three players doing it. I think now we have enough players in India. India is not India's of 1980 or 90. Enough private players, even with competition. With competition, they will find a way and do better. Now coming to your protection point, you know, protection creates inefficiency. The issue with inefficiency is, look, somebody will, we have to think about costs also. What you import is going to become expensive. Sometimes you won't be able to import what you want. There are cases, there are clear cases where you need protection. For instance, vaccines, I take it. Now, this is one extremely successful case where government openly and explicitly, we talk about this Adani and all of that, but we don't talk about vaccine making. This was a 100% success of a national champion. Government openly said, look, I'm going to favor these two guys. One guy in Hyderabad will get complete support and we will give them money explicitly. Something which is explicit, clean, well-known, you say it openly. Yeah, and you have a clear objective, and then the objective was achieved. This is a this is a truly successful national champion that I can think of, where I feel the benefits were far more than costs. But simply because some lobbyist is asking for some protection and saying that I will create so many jobs, you will miss out on the number of jobs you will lose. Because if consumers get things cheaply, they will spend on something else. Something else will get produced. You know, that cost and this cost benefit analysis needs to be done. And only when you are sure that benefits exceed costs, that is where you have to think about any kind of champion. In vaccine case, I am very clear that benefits outlay, you know, benefits are more than costs. Whereas in imposing tariffs on steel, I am not sure, because your car prices will become expensive here, you know, and car company innovation. The problem is once you give protection, innovation will suffer. Because otherwise, with competition, the person has to do it.
But if you look at the case of, you know, what we saw in Korea, the national champions innovated and now they are international names, brands.
Because that was precisely their target. You know, do we have any such companies in India which are building world-class products where, you know, even from shampoos to whatever, we don't have a single brand, unfortunately. You know, I'm a proud Indian, but I have to admit, we don't have a single... What are the best things we have created? And for every time I have to come to Blinkit and NPCI. You know, NPCI was created by government and regulators, and Blinkit was created by a startup. You know, other than, you know, what are the things which are like really truly global, will world will take note of? Our soaps are not used by people outside. Chairs we import from Malaysia. You know, if we start exporting our chairs, nobody will buy. So this is, the issue is about, you know, human capital. Issue is about competence. It's a long-term issue. You know, unless all them, if we, by protecting three, four large people, they will monopolize, they will become monopolies inside. In fact, they will reduce production. They will stifle innovation. And we will remain as, see, we have followed national champion model for too long. You know, maybe 10 instead of 4. That is what we've done all the time. And if you don't, if you think it, as I said, you know, it's case by case. You know, as I said, vaccine is one case where it's brilliantly worked. You know, if you have national champions, let's say tomorrow, China, for instance, has produced a phone, apparently, which is 100% Chinese. So tomorrow, if you think that country, if you're out of this market, you want to build something, with that objective, I appreciate. But generally, building some conglomerates, I don't think is a great idea.
Okay, let's bring in Professor Larry also on this. Professor Larry, you heard Professor Tantri there coming out very strongly on India should not be following a blanket policy of creating national champions. It should be driven by a certain criteria, driven by innovation. Are you innovating? What are you bringing to the table that you should deserve the special treatment? I wanted to get your thoughts in on this and. At the juncture that India is at right now, if not creating national champions, how do you think, in your view, what should India do to fulfill its potential, to come up with its own model of growth that drives innovation and that creates jobs? I know it's not an easy question to answer, but you know, I'm sure with your analysis and with your experience, there'll be some insight that you'll be able to offer to our viewers and hopefully to policymakers who might be watching this or listening to this.
I think the basic, you know, the basic point that I think needs to be reiterated, which is, I think, what Prasanna was saying, and so I'll just restate it in a different way. The big problem in India is actually the regulatory environment. A lot of reforms that India desperately needs is actually fiscally neutral, which is you just need regulatory reform, not really pushing money into the more money into the process. So now, what is the big issue with regulations? It's the typical size at which Indian private sector businesses like to operate. They operate at very small sizes. The question is why? So, I mean, even when you talk of the big guys, I mean, think of a very big exporter. India's biggest textile export, apparel exporter is Shahi Exports. Yeah? So Shahi Exports employs about 120,000 people. 120,000 people, but they run 50 establishments, I think the 54 establishments or something like that. So they don't go beyond 2,000 per establishment. And the establishments are spread out all over India, but no one establishment goes above 2,000. You go down to a much smaller exporter like Matrix Exports, which runs outside, you know, from Manesar in just around Delhi. They're much smaller than Shahi. They employ about 10,000 people. And how many establishments do they run? Five. Once again, doesn't go beyond 2,000. You ask, what is the typical size of a Bangladesh big exporter, big exporting establishment? About 5,000 to 6,000 people. The big Chinese exporters were about 10,000 to 12,000. That would be the size of the establishment. Where does this show up? It shows up in productivity. That these Indian establishments, even the bigger ones, have a hard time matching these big Chinese firms in terms of just the productivity. And that is related to size and scale. So why don't these guys want to grow? And the standard constraints are two, the big ones. I mean, there is the financial constraint is there, credit markets, there is a little bit of that. But the big thing that people worry about is land acquisition and land and labor. And labor is the big one. So if you talk to, and I actually gone around Delhi and India talking to exporters as to why they don't grow. And a lot of it seems to be that they're just petrified of labor laws. I know we keep talking about the fact that people have found ways of getting around it and so on and so forth. And yet, anytime you ask, do these surveys and ask these, and these are exporters, these are relatively bigger. You ask them, why don't you operate at the scale that your competitors are operating, and even in Vietnam and Bangladesh? And they'll tell you that, look, I just don't want to go beyond this number because any labor issue I run into becomes a firm-wide problem. And the laws are such that I'm going to have a really hard time getting it through, to escape unscathed. And so that's a regulatory framework. It's not just an issue of collecting 20 different codes into four codes and saying that's a labor market reform. That's not. Those things are still there. You just kind of reduce the amount of pencil work you have to do. But that's neutral. That's fiscally neutral. It doesn't cost money to get rid of a bunch of these things. And until we start operating at scale, that's where the productivity gains are going to come from. And once that happens, people, you know, this infrastructure will get built on its own. The private sector will start funding it. Which is why, I mean, when you think about land acquisition, all around these big metros, there are huge amounts of, commercial land or agricultural land being acquired and turned into commercial land and so on and so forth. The private sector is doing it. You never hear a word about how this land got, all the constraints that these big firms faced in trying to acquire that land. They just got it done. Because the NPV was high enough that they somehow paid whoever needed to be paid, and they got it done. Where we run into issues is anytime the government tries to acquire land. That's when all the big issues show up because, the land acquisition price is not quite what everybody thinks that they should get paid. So, in general, I think the bottom line is if the net present values are high enough, these projects will get done, will get built. Mm. We have to create high NPVs. And so that is about productivity. That is about profits that you can kind of bring on board that private investors have to be able to see. The regulatory environment is fundamental, and that is fiscally neutral. That's the big thing. You don't That's have right. to throw money at it.
Correct.
It's political capital, but it's not financial capital.
So, you know, I, as a journalist who's been reporting on the Indian economy for now 23 years, I just feel like, will the conversation ever change? You know, because this is something that we have spoken about, I've written about it, and we are still talking about the same things. Prasanna, if I, you know, I could request you to come in on this. Has, you know, whatever Professor Lahiri said is absolutely right. The regulatory landscape needs to become better. We have gone up in the ease of doing business rankings and so on. But when it comes to, you know, one, what is the data saying on ground? Because private investment is still not picked up. We are looking at, a 6.5% growth for a country that has had a stable government now for nearly 12 years. And so, you know, I want to get a sense from you on what has changed on ground when it comes to productivity, when it comes to regulatory landscape, and what are your expectations and hopes from Modi 3.0 to take this momentum forward and take us to 8% growth, because that's what we really need.
On finance, I would give slightly higher weightage than what Professor Lahiri gave. It may be biased being a finance person. See what is things, you know, what has improved is you know, the consistency, at least, you know, things are not changing every day. On the digital front, things have become much better. You know, your transaction costs have gone down accordingly, significantly, and there is stability. These things have improved, but what has not improved is this still, although rules have gotten liberalized, but still that on the ground bureaucracy, implementation, inspection, that has not changed. If you go and talk to SMEs, I'll give a simple example. Some of the well-intentioned policies, there was a recent rule which said you have to pay SMEs within 45 days, otherwise you don't get tax deduction. Now on the face of it looks like a great revolutionary measure that helps small firms. But then what happened? The large firms have small firms that look, if you don't re-register from the Udyam portal, we will not give you any business. Because what these policymakers, some of them at the lower level or even at the higher level, do not understand that ultimately transactions or terms of trade are determined by economic forces. If you constrain on one hand, something else will open up. So a lot of well-intentioned policies have created same thing with access. Why do firms, Professor Lahiri asked this question, why do firms not grow? Labor he has already spoken about. I will not go there. But I'll tell you finance. If you keep promoting SMEs, small firms, I have a paper where I show that at the threshold, firms don't want to grow. Because if you grow above, then you will not be SME. Not a small firm, then you will not get all the privileges. So why should I grow? It's a, many of these well-intentioned policies are actually hurting. And third, and more important, even the RBI, whatever importance finance is, RBI wants zero failure. Now, you cannot run a zero failure system. I understand you have learned lessons from financial crisis. But if you start seeing any increase in unsecured lending, there's a very nice paper by Dr. Rajan in the Journal of Finance, very clearly shows that countries, as they develop, cash flow based lending picks up. It's a very nice correlation. As you grow, you will be financed less by collateralized lending. It's a cash flow based lending. Now we have a very nice digital environment which is suited for cash flow based lending. Now you know about these people. You have GST. But then if you have regulators saying that even a small uptick in unsecured loan, it will be a systematic crisis, and then they start going after lenders, non-banking finance corporation, which lend to these small firms, then this will constrain growth. So even regulators and policymakers, on the one hand, easing when they ease stuff, on the other hand, if they start applying brakes, if they don't realize that environment is different, then you're never going to grow. You know, I'm not very optimistic about the current, and mind you, we are in a falling savings rate regime. In the long run, it's not consumption that creates growth. In the long run, you need investments and productivity, and for investment, you need savings. So right. I don't know how we can 8.5-9% if we either do not promote savings, do not get FDI, or increase productivity. And you know these constraints. Labor is one, finance is another. We need to improve access to finance. Even that's equally important.
Okay. Very quickly, closing comments, Professor Lahiri. Any lessons that India can learn from its, East Asian neighbors on building effective and innovative national champions?
I think the national champion model is. I'm not convinced that model can be replicated in the Indian context today, because the environment in which they were operating was very different. In particular, you're going to run, in order to keep these national champions efficient, you have to somehow link the benefits they're getting to some external markers of competitiveness. And that itself is sort of going against, if you try to subsidize their export activities, you're only going to run into problems. I think, frankly, for me, the way that the best way to get infrastructure done is to create increasing demand for it from the private sector, and then the money will flow in. And that is a function of how productive the environment seems to be. Business profitability, is it looking good? Is it not? Do private businesses want to come in? This idea that they're not coming in because there is no infrastructure, I think that may well, be overhyped. I mean, one has to look at it from the other side.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much for that. And Prasanna, your closing comments, the big vulnerabilities that India faces if it indeed follows the national champion policy, what are you sensing at this point? Do you think it raises like a big credibility question for India anytime? Questions are raised on, say, corporate governance practices in a national, being practiced in a national champion company, that immediately has a bearing on India. And maybe this could be like a wake-up call, a moment of reckoning for India that, we need to maybe have a more, all-rounded approach towards building businesses, nurturing businesses, and ensuring growth.
Exactly. So, in fact, if you see, I sit on the board of a public sector company. In fact, governance in India has actually improved. But now, if you get one or two corporations as representative of government, they become national champions. Something happening in one or two companies will start reflecting as if the entire country is going down. That's not true. There is no phone banking these days, and things dramatically improve. A lot of situations. But then you can, if you argue on that, somebody can just cite one or two examples, and these companies are treated as the country, and then entire country, and then your FDI can actually go down, not go up. But I'm not that, as I said, vaccine was a successful case. Another area where it can be really successful is solar. We talk about alternative energy, and I deal with power sector, and solar, we have a competitive advantage. So if you can have a PLI kind of a scheme, which is linked to innovation. Current PLI is based on investment. Why can't we have a PLI based on innovation? Right? Yeah. In areas where we have competitive advantage. Solar is, and the entire world is looking at alternative. And we need another, we have 500 gigabytes now. We need another 500 gigabytes in some, domestic only. And there, if you promote, and if it can lead to innovation, lead to something which world is not doing, like our UPI and UPI and Blinkit and these kind of things show that we are capable of it, then why not? We don't have a problem. Simply promoting certain groups where things can be done with multiple groups, that's not, I don't think, is a ideal way of helping the country.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much, for sharing your perspective on this, Professor Larry and Professor Tanchi. Thank you so much. I know it's pretty late for you, Professor Larry, so really appreciate you taking out the time. And Professor Tanchi, thank you so much for that very candid assessment. A big thank you to both of you, in fact. So, there are no easy answers to India's model of growth, but the fundamentals remain the same. The fundamentals, as been pointed out by Professor Larry and Professor Tanchi, is that we need to make it productive for businesses to operate in India. We need to nurture, we need to build an ecosystem for innovation, and India perhaps should not consider a blanket policy for creating national champions, but decide the sectors where it can work better, decide on the basis of the innovation that's coming in, and so on. No easy answers there, obviously, because India is a complex country with unique advantages and unique challenges. So hopefully, from what the narrative that we're seeing at this point could prod the government into a bit of a rethink on how they'd like to, build and nurture Indian companies going forward. Thanks so much for watching, and do send us your comments and feedback right here in the comments section below. And big thank you for tuning in. Thanks so much for watching.